scale and faculty member in the Department of English and CRPS Critical Race Gender Sexuality Studies. I'd like to thank the library for co-hosting us with CRPS and Cooney especially, who always makes things happen. Just to say a few things about Reyna. Reyna Leon is a member of the Carolina African American Writers Collective and has been published in numerous journals as a writer of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. Her first collection of poetry, Canticle of Idols, was finalist for both the Cave Canem First Poetry Prize and the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. Her second book, Blooming at Dawn, was finalist for the Naomi Long Magic Prize. Her third book, Sombra Dislocate, was published in 2016. She has received fellowships and residencies with Cave Canem, Count del Mundo, the Montana Artist Refuge, the McDowell Colony, Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts, Vermont Studio Center, the Tyrone Guthrie Center in Anna McCary, Ireland, and Ragdale. She is also a founding editor of the Acentos Review, an online quarterly international journal devoted to the promotion and publication of Latino and Latina arts. She is an associate professor of education at St. Mary's College of California. So join me in welcoming Reyna Leon.
Wow, it is great to be with y'all today. So I'm going to be reading a number of poems from all of my books and notes and things like that. So I hope that you'll go on a journey with me. I am going to be reading especially poems about family throughout. So I've never done this sequence before, so I'm pretty excited to see how we go. Southwest Philadelphia, 1988. Our eyes focused on swirled vats, vanilla ice cream, then cherry water ice, more vanilla cherry for a tower of red and white stripes that melted into pink after heat stroll. We had to wait for tall plastic cups, like all the brown kids, while Papi grumbled, "Miss, why we always gotta wait? We were here first. My children were here first." Counter girls sucked their teeth, gloved their hands, only for us. Blackness was catching the neighborhood, pecking ravens in flight, us and them. But we never noticed that then. Children with stained history, my brother, fair-skinned and universal prize, and me, black and not, walked the block with the evidence there, cherry, crystal-flecked jackets, happy. Poppy held our hands, brooding the cost. Okay, so some poems. So my brother and I are very, very close, but I tried to kill him more than once. And so I was talking to my mother, I think it was in college, about all the many times I tried to kill Tito. And because it was desperate. It wasn't like normal trying to kill him. I like ran after him with a knife several times. And my brother, he told this story, which I had not known until that point, that he used to sleep on his back. But the reason was not because, oh, I'm comfortable, I'm a back sleeper. It was because if he heard the door opening, he could jump out of bed and close the door, because he was that afraid of me coming. Now, I wasn't coming for him at night, but like the fact that he was that worried. And so I told my mom this story, my brother also telling his, when I was in college. This is part of this longer conversation that we were having. And my mom was like, "Oh my God, I would have gotten you help, Reyna." Like, but we're very close now. So this is the poem from there. "Fly, little brother, fly. That old kitchen butcher knife with that miserly crooked point burned black at the edge. I remember the whistling as I ran with it high, cutting the living room air, making sparks fly. You were a road runner, little boy, alive." I was wily and wanted you dead. Perhaps I would have eaten you. Coyote, Nash, and Pull, I knew you would reawaken in full form, be the South Park Kenny of Philadelphia with a Spanish name. If you had been a girl, and just like me, I never would have run the knife along your door. I never would have scratched in your nightmares. I never would have laughed as you cried. But you were that sand soil thing that made mommy fat. You were the biter, the screamer, the urine stained. You were the beloved. I attempted to make your skin open wide to gushing red rivers. I am not sorry. I actually am. It's a good thing you learned to fly over the stairs and Superman leaps. Smart boy, I didn't walk until I was two. You could be a dead fly in my old coffee by now. It's a good thing you learned to fly. So, my poor brother. but I'll read this poem. There's a poem that I read earlier on the football field about my brother and talking about race, but I'll read this other one about a conversation we had. Tracks. There's a train coming, and my brother runs as fast as he can in his business slacks and crisp cotton shirt. His dress shoes slap their distaste at the pace, but there is a train coming. He runs from his tears, those he would never weep at work for a girl he hardly knew, but he knew her story. It never gets easier, I tell him, I had a friend once. There is a train coming, and it's Kelsey's train. It laughs like her and clacks that sound like metal on wood, accompanied by the lilt of baby laughter. She was such a good kid, he intones over and over. I am on the phone that he holds, and then not. It never gets easier, your first death as an adult, hard, worse is suicide. His breath not being enough for explanation and charge forward, he cuts me off. I am left behind to imagine him running, full thrust of body, he leans into the wind and chill, which is Kelsey's last breath, her last cold breath. It smells like ash, salt, and blood, he runs. On that train is a way back home, just a physical, real way home. But hiding in the faces of those who sit, jostling to the train's rumble rhythm, are Kelsey's lips and Kelsey's hair, her good-natured touch, an invitation. Behind their eyes, she explores a danceable dark, oblivion, mysteries, mess, just a doorway that she walked through when all the others had closed, slammed shut, or been pried open, so bloody she was unable to see a way through, pink splitting from black and blue, crimson outpouring. No God who cares, who loves, would hurt a child for a mistake. She was ill, created that way. A milky pool can be a haven, extend to shroud. Behind it, her own eyes are plucked. Add to that the rough road. It's not like she didn't have choices, but she didn't have good ones. On the train are people he does not know, and some he does. He has left work early, but they ask no questions. Others pass him onto the train, but there is something about the look of the snow and sleet on the windows, dragged as if to spell a name, but he has a choice. I won't sugarcoat it. You will ache. She is precious, but know that you are precious too. He can step on or sit in the rain that could be a hurricane or tornado spikes. If the rain falls is more than rain, something like an old woman's rage at having another young woman to carry, then he should sit and bear it, suffer her suffering rather than ride a train that has already borne a heavy load. If the train is just rain, not something cosmic, a sign of malevolence, a world off kilter where the children kill themselves for lack of something, then he should step onto the grooved floor, add his own filth to the lake at the door. Nothing can change it. The train has arrived. You must live in ways she never could. I don't know what he chose. Okay. So family, family, family. So my dad is also a character. He's a storyteller. I never know half of what's true or not. And like for years, I actually didn't know my father's true name until I was 32, around there. My parents were visiting. I was working already at St. Mary's. And my mom was talking about how she didn't know his name until only a year before. They had been married for like 40 years at that point. And she was like, yeah, I always thought his name was Eduardo. And no, his name is not Eduardo, it's Eddie. That is what is on his birth certificate, because his father, so his father had a best friend when he was a merchant marine named Eddie, not Eduardo, Eddie. So he named his son Eddie. But my uncles are Nelson and Miguel, Felix, right? And he's Eddie. And so he wanted a Spanish name like his brothers. So he went by Eduardo his whole life. My mother doesn't know his true name until she applies for his passport. And she had to get his real birth certificate, which he had lost or never had, so she has to get it, and that's how she finds out his name. So this is the same conversation where he tells me how he was in the Boy Scouts as a kid, and I'm like, you're lying. because how was my grandmother, who like was struggling all the time, going to afford the Boy Scouts? And my mom was like, no, he really was. He was in the Boy Scouts. I don't know what's the truth. So my dad would also tells me these stories, these really random stories, at the most like chill circumstances. So this came literally, it's true, while we were having breakfast. He just made me pancakes. Addict. Mahogany maple syrup runs in spider web lines. My father never uses the stuff. He eats pancakes powdered, butter moist. When I was a child, he knew more of straightness. Lines and razors were friends. One night, he tried to die by his hand. A girl jumped before he walked to the ledge. Her mangled body wore the rails like a girdle. Her limbs so thin, she became a blood putty. Angel, her name. They had to lift the train to take her out. And he told me this story literally over pancakes. And I was, for the rest of my time living in the house that I grew up in Philadelphia, I was haunted by the sound of the train. The train nearby that would always go by like around 3 a.m. And every time I heard that, I would think that could have been the train that took my father. But he was saved in a way by someone else's sacrifice, their loss. So here's another father poem. Spanish interpreter certificate from Boogeyman Dawn. For Eduardo Eddie León. Oh, this is the other part of that story. So my brother, who is named after my father, is not named after my father. Right? My mother named my brother Eduardo after his father. He's not named after our father. His name is Eddie. My brother's name should be Eddie, which is actually what he goes by. But so Spanish interpreter certificate. My father whimpers he might be stupid. So he reads the books twice, memorizes the words, and places them in my mouth so I won't ever be dumb. Cálculo biliar, muela caudal, laringe, gallstone, wisdom tooth, larynx, and other names of the body's hidden places, the caverns for aches. He needs me to explore the words with my tongue, repeat them with the muscles of my face. His is still scarlet with the punch, a priest placed there when he was 14, didn't know the meaning of courtesy in English, or how to be poor and still proud. He thought himself stupid. At 57, he leaks the shame, but he wants to learn, walks in rain to classes, though his knees throb arthritic and his vision fails in dark places. He sits with the other multi-tongued, those who would interpret when pain thickens too much for hands to sign. My father is not stupid. He passed his class, his test at the top of his class, just far too intelligent not to suffer. And there was just such bitterness when he recounted that story of being punched for not knowing a word. Okay, so I've talked about my brother, talked about my dad. It's my mom's turn. She hates this poem. Catholic puberty lessons. One, my mother cultivated crossed ankle sit, demure knee press slant. Your girly cloth will show. No one would want to see that thing underneath. Coochie must always be clenched, closed. She taught the eventuality of blood through a blue covered book borrowed from the public library. I would have to return it. She too embarrassed to go twice. My mother did not prepare me. Bloody pillows worn between legs, how to dispose of red rag disgrace, secrecy answered in the swoosh of flush. The plumber pulled pads. Each branded scarlet streak on her face, the wet tunnel hides nothing. Two, my mother relinquished my sex education, a book not enough for puzzled looks, to Catholic school. I learned by rote. Eve sinned. God punished. Period. Labor. Labor pains. One was bad, but the other, the devil courted with handsome faces, labor without ring, meant hell. Enter the promised chastity belt of vows. I prayed to enter the convent. At least the nuns, brides of Christ, ecstasy burned all the time. There were no shame, no closet nuns. Rocking in church, Latin grit in throats, they carried their rosary dicks, crucifixes on their chains, seemed immaculate still, unsullied beneath the veil. Intuitively, I knew convent cloisters never would welcome me. Perhaps it was the desire for body over body and blood. She hates that poem. So, birthplace. So I had all this guilt as a kid because my father told me the story of how I almost killed my mother. And the story is pretty much that I almost killed my mother by being born, that I was a problematic birth. There had to be an emergency C-section. She got an infection, so I went home, and then she was in this wing for a week additionally. And she tells the story without the guilt part. But she tells the story of being placed right down the hall from the maternity wing. And so for a week she was without her baby, and she could hear all these mothers with their babies. Crying babies. But this is the piece from that birthplace. The vessel splits. Water soaks pedestal legs, thick to the trembling fat, waddling columns beneath still heavy core. She pushes, expels like other women. Her sister labored only minutes. But that child trusted hands to catch, to unmuffle the screen with a swipe. This child, bicycle churns feet, trusts no one to bring her to earth safe. Blood that sticks, breach she will not return to turn. Scalpels cut the fabric skin, stretch mark asylum, a body sets out, infection sets in, a babe alone. Still hungry from vestigial morphing, she despised her mother's fat, I'm getting so fat, and spite swallowed her own twin, like this is life fat, and mine. Now girl unfurls her cries with a swaddled throng. While her mother weeps a week, childless, her breast dry, solitary confinement of staff, hearing other women's babies cry for milk. And yes, I believe I swallowed my own twin. So my mom thought she was having one baby, then she went to the doctor and they said, surprise, you're having two. And then by the next appointment, they said, no, you're really only having one. So I don't know if it was a mistake in reading the ultrasound, but I like to go with the idea that I have this whole other person in me. I don't know why I like that image, but I do. So I'm going to read you one. So I grew up by an airport in Philadelphia. It was 5 minutes away, and my grandfather – My mother's father, when he would come from western Pennsylvania, very, very rural area, he would sit on the porch and he would watch these planes go by. And they would fly so low that you could almost see inside them, that you could see the people in the windows. And he was just always amazed by that. So this is my old address too. On the cement patio of 2741 South 78th Street, after James Wright. Sitting on the cemented patio, I see the wild of my mother's garden, showered with blushings that swirl down from the knotted tulip tree. In giant shadow, grass will not grow. Roots yawn out, looping lazily about one another, gluttons of the earth's bounty on the edge of Philadelphia. I lean back in the unstable lawn chair and crinkle my nose at the mingling perfume of home. Sewage, refined oil, and roses. A plane roars its gruff salutation low enough almost to touch a belly heavy with life, while the neighbor's boxers yelp their warnings with toothy, dripping mouths. I have lost my way. And that's the poem. I think I have time maybe for three more poems. Yeah. So this is a poem for my nephew who died at 58 days old. His sister, Ava, they were both my godbabies, so I'm very proud to be her godmother. She's almost five now. Eden, for Aiden Gregory Century, 58 days old. One, paradise to flesh. Here buzzes the song of fireflies floating, silent lanterns illuminate the haze. She swallowed bugs. Her abdomen glows beneath my hand, a pounding sways beneath the growing globe of her body. Two, sonogram. Ava, our little bird, Aiden, our little fire, the doctor asks if my sister and me want to see the faces. I swell, nod my head through tears, and the machine uncoils one face in a hush. My sister's forehead, a flat plane, her husband's nose, all button and wide. Ava's eyes seem open, and I wonder what world she sees. Aiden won't twist. We sing and warm him by pressing on my sister's belly with care. He sleeps stubbornly. He has shown his heart. The limping pulse that must be enough. Turning is too much. We smile, not knowing. I hold Ava's picture like an icon, staring deep into the eye pits until I feel her stare back. Three, NICU. I hold Ava and Aiden is ash. Fires burn so fast, he flash in air, no fanning would keep the ember steady. Ash on wind, he's gone. Ash on my tongue where I kissed his smooth forehead, newly washed tape residue that affixed the monitors of his life. Four. On the last day, I held Ava's hand to Aiden's the first and last time in this world. My sister said, like a prayer, they'll play together in their dreams. The others left. I remained a moment while the girl cried a goodbye her lips could not form, while he heard a goodbye he could not know. And when it was time for the machines to stop, I carried the bird away from the fire, heavy, heavy, I lost my way, a labyrinth of curtains, infants in pain, mothers weeping in whispers or in thanks to a god, many. How had that storm found its way into sunny, sterile halls? I could barely see for the glare, refracting from the streaming glass, strange and terrible wonderland. I must be dreaming. Alone, I carried the sister while her brother closed his eyes for his first bath. Okay. And I think I'm going to read you the poem, a poem that I read last night about my husband, because he's family too. and it has a beginning from a cabaret. Anybody know cabaret? Maybe this time. Yeah. So I'm going to sing a piece of that and then go into the poem. It's called Maybe. Maybe this time I'll be lucky. Maybe this time he'll stay. Maybe this time, for the first time, love won't hurry away. Maybe when I kiss his lips, honey will coil in the caverns of my mouth, buzz with a sweetness that comes from traveling on air, trusting that somewhere there will be the stuff of engoldening. And yes, I made that word up. Maybe when I grace his beard, tremulous, the feel of petal gruff will root at the nub, thrill me to giggling like a child running through the thrush magic of a lavender field in full bloom. And maybe when I nuzzle his hair as he rests his head at my breast, the coconut oil perfume will transport us to beachside languor, where even in stillness there is the cool clarity of breeze blow breath. And maybe, just maybe, he'll remain fiery to panting, as inexhaustible as the sun. Now suns do cool, stars fail, disappear with a wink, galactic fireflies in the distance, bearers of a thousand names, or long dead before carrying one. Nothing lasts forever, but a moment, a maybe, that seems to extend to yes. Okay. all right. So I'm going to let y'all decide this last poem. So there's a poem that's ecstatic and trance-like. And then there's a poet that's a poem that's about funk. So I heard funk first. Okay, that's where we're going. That's where we're going. And the rest of y'all were like, I didn't know that's how we were playing. okay, so here's New Orleans funk. Before I read this, last poem. So any of you know Rebirth Brass Band? What are you doing with your lives? Like, so after this, go to Spotify or Pandora or Tidal, whatever your service is, and check them out, okay? So then you'll know the liveliness of this group based in New Orleans. New Orleans Funk, which I happened to see long time back, like 2006 or so, and it was just ecstatic, funky, sweaty amazingness, right? Okay, New Orleans Funk. Between his legs, he's swaying a blasting walls horn while his fingers pound the keys to blare with funk. A bastard drum stolen from his mama busts loose, a twisting spirit jig jump marching on the stage with a thumped out second rhythm, while stick fists fade into funk kung fu glow. Saxophone steady rise, the light fantastic, while the tuba man spreads the salty butter of his bass call. Walls slick down in this ramshackle place where the men carry knives and the women razors, but while the wine and rhythm spirits possess them and they sweat the joyful grind and pull, there's no blood tonight. Hang on the corner and you won't get in. Heaven has a throng of parasail twirlers, handkerchief wavers, dancing in the second line. You have to push that hip bone in and shimmy to the front where the day coffin bearer sings the song of the soul. And when the wood is planted down, what is left? Rapture, rocking the flesh until it falls. Thank y'all. Okay, I'm going to dare to open my tea and hope that this isn't disastrous. So questions, what are your questions? I think my mason jar has sealed on me. Oh, yeah, okay, excellent, no mess. Yes?
You mentioned your mom's response to your mom. I was curious about your brother.
Oh yeah, so my brother, so when my first book came out and I read some of those poems, and I read Attic, for example, I expected my father in particular to be really upset because it does talk about his addiction. I expected my brother to also be like shamed and not feel good about that. But my family as a whole has always been super supportive. And so it's like, it's not like you're telling anything untrue. So, I don't know if I ever sent the poem to him. I never asked permission. I suppose asked for forgiveness later. But my brother has never had a problem, especially with that poem on the football field. It's not totally true, but there are some pieces of it that are, the important pieces of it are. But in the end, he's so supportive of everything I do. So, yeah. We are very close now. Of course, that's the piece that I meant to read you. So in that book, in Boogeyman Dawn, there's another piece called Sisterly Advice, which is how my brother and I talk about yielding knives. This is a very like stereotypical Puerto Rican thing to do. Like very stereotypical. But I think it was very much a part of my father's growing up experience, needing to be protected and needing to know, whether through fists or with a knife, how to survive, and passing that knowledge on to my brother and I, knowing what he had experienced in New York and in Philadelphia. And so my brother and I would, on occasion have these discussions about what's the best knife to carry. I don't carry a knife anymore. No need to be scared. my sister, on the other hand, that's a whole other story. But I hope that answers your question. There was a hand. Yes.
Do you have other poets in your family? And who was a mentor or like someone that you grew up wanting to write like?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So my mom is a poet. So I originally started out writing fiction. And I would write these terribly sad stories, and I would force my mother to read them, and she would say, "It's a great story, Raina, but why are they always so sad?" But as a kid, my mom actually gave me my first book of poetry, and I started writing poetry from a very young age. About 8 was when my first, the first poem that I really remember writing, and I kept it for years in a little album. And now my mom, who's just retired, is returning to that poetic part of her. She's working on her own poems, hopefully for a manuscript. I've been telling her this for years. Sometimes she listens to me. Poet mentors. So I don't think I really had a poet mentor that I aspired to be like in particular until I read the work of Sonia Sanchez, Amiri Baraka, and Marilyn Nelson. So I was inspired by books first, and so my honors thesis in undergrad was very like, I thought revolutionary. It was like all about America with 3 Ks, like, very much inspired by the poets of the Black Arts Movement, and who I'd never met. Later I met both in different circumstances. But it was really Marilyn Nelson in meeting her at Cave Canem in 2003 who just changed my whole world as far as like who I want to be as a poet. She said about form that sometimes, she's very much a formalist, and that sometimes you have to use form to get you through the emotional turmoil, essentially. And so she has a book, for example, A Wreath for Emmett Till, who died when she was about the same age. Really great book. It's pitched as a children's book because it has illustrations, but it's not. It can be used that way, but it's a crown of sonnets. It's very complex. So she's the first person that I read her work, and I wanted to learn to have that gentleness within the line and the strength of the form as well. And she's also super approachable. So she's still my Facebook friend. And when I was thinking about applying for a Fulbright in Brazil, her son happened to live there at the time, and she made all these connections for me. I met the woman, like really spent time with her like twice. And she's always been this incredible force from a very early time. And I have a lot of other poet mentors and poet colleagues in collective now, but I think she was the first one who was like, okay, this is what it means to be in community. So, other questions? I'm really not scary, y'all. I'm really not. Yes.
Thank you for being here, Anna.
You're welcome.
So nice to hear you again. Did you ever consider a career in music?
Good question. So when I was in undergrad, I was part of a touring choir called Essence of Joy, and took a while to become a part of it. I could read music because I played beginning piano, but more intermediate clarinet as a kid, and had learned a little cello, and had been in choirs for a long time, but I hadn't been able to read music for voice, right? I was able to read music for instrument. So I learned that skill, was a part of this choir, and thought that I always wanted to be found. I think there are musicians who are like, this is my calling, and I will make the band happen, and I'll seek out lessons and all of this. But I didn't have that urge or that confidence. I never had that confidence in anything that I did as far as instrumentation or instrument or voice as instrument. So I would always have this idea that, you know, someday someone will find me and say, oh, your voice is amazing, or something that you've done is so great, let's work together on this. So, and maybe something would happen from there. But, so I never thought about professionally unless I was found. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Cool. Yeah.
Can you tell us what advice you give to young writers?
Oh, yeah. So I think the best advice, some advice is to be about your craft, to read constantly, and to write only after having written, after having read deeply, because we learn a lot about craft from what we consume, one thing. The other is that for me, writing has never been just a solitary practice. That yes, of course, I need the space to write, the mental space to write as well, and it's important to find that. Especially as a teacher, my creativity often goes into what I do for my students, my lesson plans, my exercises, and so on. And I forget about how important it is to siphon some of that from my writing. So being clear about making the boundaries for one's creativity. But it's not a solitary act that you do in the night with that candle and that tumbler of whiskey or something, which is kind of the image that so many people think about. And there are spirits in the room, I don't know. But that writing is informed by and nurtured within community. And for me, that's been through Canto Mundo, Cave Canem, the Carolina African American Writers Collective, Macondo, building community, setting up reading series, being a part of open mic communities, going and attending the reading series of my friends, and learning from them, and writing down lines that I love, and contributing and doing workshops together. And that's what's improved my writing the most. So that's what I would offer to young writers, those who are beginning or anyone beginning on that path, to really find your people and when I say your people, those who are also dedicated to writing and to reading together, to learning in that way, because you don't have to find someone who has the same, who's a poet as well, or a poet who, like you, is an eco-poet, if you ascribe to that identity. I think having a lot of people who do different things but are invested in the word, and if your work is also in the work, in political, socio-political work, social justice work, people who also do that, so that you can push one another. And to the last thing I would say is to, and I said to read, but to read outside of your comfort zone. Because I'm very, very comfortable in the work of people of color in general, but a lot of narrative, like a lot of the work that I am most familiar with is very narrative. And what I learned from the MFA and what I'm continuing in practice is to also be informed by the experimental, things that really push me to spend hours reading with other people and talking about it, so that I can think through what this really means for me. Is that, yeah? That's a lot of advice. I hope you wrote it all down, because I don't remember. Go ahead.
Is there a writer who was, or maybe is still, out of your comfort zone who has made you a better writer by reading them?
So, out of my comfort zone, who's made me a better... So, I think Alice Notley. I just read last year Benediction, which there are all these repetitious themes within it. It's very immersive. She creates a whole world within it, and there's a lot of language, and you can get lost within it. So there's a trance kind of aspect for me in reading her work, which is a very different experience. It's not, I kept trying and reading that book in particular, trying to make a narrative, but it doesn't. That's what I'm reading onto it, but I just had to let it go. And another one is Ronalda Wilson. I think the book is Farther Traveler. I think that's what the title is. Because it is experimental, it uses prose, it uses prose poems, it uses form like lyric essays within it. It also uses like experimental poetic form within it. And I like this. This going back and forth between multiple forms and what that does when they are juxtaposed to one another. It's not something that I do generally do at all in my work. So those are two things that stand out immediately. Totally recommend them. Yeah.
What advice would you have for new teachers specifically in navigating the politics of the administration while at the same time getting your students?
Okay. Politics of administration and getting your students what they need. So one thing is to always couch whatever you are doing or planning to doing with, this is what my students need. And because it's hard for an administrator to fight that, because they're supposed to be about the students. So that's one thing, is to always focus in on what is it that is at the core of this. Administrators can, depending on what's going on in their lives, in the school's life, can be extremely supportive and visionary, and then can also be boxed in themselves. So I don't envy those folk who are in that position, actually, because it can be very hard. You have administrators in particular who are really deeply connected with community, and then you have some who are their office people and haven't taught for many years. So one thing as well is that balance is to, if there's ever a question, to invite an administrator into your classroom, which can be frightening, right? This is my boss coming into my classroom. But to talk through what just happened, why was this person invited? And I used to invite my principal into my class all the time, especially when we were doing something different, right? One of the schools that I worked with was at a very project-based school. And so he would come in my class, for example, in my Spanish class, when my students were cooking in the class, which is probably like totally a fire hazard. I bought these burners. They're all in my classroom. I couldn't get the catering space, so the kitchen on campus. So I bought these burners. My students are cooking in the classroom, and we had invited the parents to come in, and my students were they crafted a menu. They were having restaurant wars in Spanish. This is my Spanish 1 class, so they're just learning, and they had learned how to, you know, say, "Would you like a menu?" and those kind of things with their parents. In the room. So I invited my administrator there, like, "This is what I'm doing. And don't you think I need more money?" So that has been helpful. And another thing is that providing research when you know that they're wrong and they just don't know. So, because how can you fight against what's good for your kids and there's research to support it? Ah, you can't fight me on that. You can't fight me on that. So so sometimes you got to do your homework, but also collaborating with other teachers on doing that too. Is that helpful?
Totally.
Cool. Yeah. Yes.
When you were first starting out as a poet, what were some challenges you faced as a woman poet?
Oh, good question. Doubt. Doubt was my biggest one. And getting past the rejections. How many of you have submitted work before, whether prose, poetry, anything, photos, anything, and you've gotten the rejections? And then, at least for me, crushed. I'm never writing again. It's racism. This editor doesn't know. It's because they saw my name, and it's because my name has an accent, and that's why. So I, for a long time, I wouldn't even write my full name. I would write R.J. Leon. And then I was like, well, fuck. Like, if it's really my accent, then if it's really my name, then I still got a last name. So if it is, then this is not the press for me, right? So getting past that and the rejections and feeling like that this was proof that I just don't know anything and I shouldn't be a writer. And then it was also with that doubt of like, how do I keep doing this? And when am I ever going to find a space that's going to trust in my work and trust in me? And eventually, part of that was like starting my own, right? Starting the Essentials Review in 2008, because there were a number of presses and journals specifically that would publish works in Spanish or in Spanglish, but not many. And so starting something with a community that I was a part of helped with like saying, pushing past my self-doubt and then focusing on what we can do as a community. So, does that answer your question? Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you all.